This is Science Friday from NPR News. I'm Ira Flatow. We're in Tallahassee today, broadcasting from Florida State University, where they are celebrating the 200th anniversary of Charles Darwin's birth. And by the way, this is also the 150th year since the publication of On the Origin of Species, Darwin's manuscript that laid out his new theory of evolution by natural selection. Of course, everyone has heard of Darwin. He gets most of the credit for the theory of evolution. And while he deserves to be recognized for his contributions, of course, he couldn't have gotten there without some help. And so for the rest of the hour, the rest of the story, as the late Paul Harvey might have said today. In his new book, Remarkable Creatures, my first guest tells us about scientists and adventurers, some trained, some, many of them, self-taught, who inspired Darwin and helped prove that he was right, from Alexander Van Humboldt to Henry Bates and Roy Chapman Andrews, the names that you might not have heard of, but whose contributions really were enormous. There's even one naturalist who was, let's say, dangerously close to scooping Darwin on his own work. So we're going to talk all about that with my guest, Sean B. Carroll. He is the author of Extraordinary Creatures, Epic Adventures in the Search for the Origins of Species. He's a professor of molecular biology and genetics at the University of Wisconsin. I'm sure he's happy to be here in Florida today. Yes, and investigator at the Howard Hughes Medical Institute. Welcome back to Science Friday.
Thanks for having me, Ira.
The title of your book, I think it really has a double meaning, Extraordinary Creatures, because I think it's talking about some of the people in the book as well as the animals. They were extraordinary people, or were they not?
Absolutely. So these were people that had tremendous spirit, tremendous passion for exploring the unknown, and they were driven to discover strange and beautiful creatures or bizarre fossils or ancient hominids, whatever it might be. So, yeah that's an intentional double.
You know, and I didn't realize how brave some of these people. They went through malaria and floods and what kinds of shipwrecks, things like that.
Yeah, cannibals, poisonous snakes, sandstorms, bandits, any number of years spent in jungles or deserts. Sometimes it was the animals that were the most dangerous, sometimes it was the infectious diseases, sometimes it was the other people that were around. So that was a part of the game of exploring the parts of the world that most of the modern world didn't know about.
Our number is 1-800-989-8255 if you'd like to talk with Sean Carroll about his book and about origins in general. Also, you can tweet us on Twitter at SciFri, the at sign and SCIFRI. And also in Second Life, a whole bunch of avatars are collecting in our Second Life Island, and you can in our Science Friday Island, you can join them and ask questions there too. Let's talk about some of these people that most people have never heard about. Let's begin where you began, with a really very interesting guy named Alexander Van Humboldt. Who was he?
Well, Humboldt was a wealthy Prussian, a polymath. He was versed in every field of science and many other disciplines as well. He was very well traveled. He had done a fair amount of experimental science in Europe, testing the electrical activity of tissues, many of those experiments conducted on himself.
Ouch.
Yeah. And then he undertook a voyage in 1799 to 1804, where he traveled through South America and much of Central America, and wound up that voyage, in fact, in the United States by visiting with Thomas Jefferson. But in the course of that voyage, he was a compulsive measurer, so he measured everything, the heights of mountains, the temperature of various waters, taking star positions. He documented a lot of the pre-Columbian world that people didn't know about, collected all sorts of botanical specimens, zoological specimens. He played various games with, for example, electric eels. He was interested in electrical things, and so he and his companion, a botanist named Aimé Bonpland, they would sort of handle these eels, and they'd try to figure out if one was handling and touched the other person, would they get a shock, et cetera. So it was
Did they shock themselves?
Well, they said, I don't think they ever figured out exactly what the rhyme or reason was. They just reported that the jolt was so strong, it was stronger than anything they had felt in Europe when they were doing deliberate experiments with electricity. So, so he was fascinated by everything, and he documented everything. Wound up his trip, as I said, by going to the United States to sit down with Thomas Jefferson.
That sounds amazing. Just because Jefferson was an amateur scientist himself, and he's interested in all this stuff.
Right. So of all things, imagine a letter. The letter of introduction was, to Thomas Jefferson saying, well, I would like to sit down and talk with you about fossils. Jefferson was a fossil collector. He had brought a lot of fossils to the White House, and he had written what we think is the first American paper on paleontology prior to becoming president. And he thought that these great creatures that were represented by things like mastodons and mammoths and an animal that Jefferson had described that was a kind of giant ground sloth, he thought they were still roaming somewhere in the American West. Jefferson did not think that animals could go extinct. And so when he sent, for example, Lewis and Clark West, he told them to be on the lookout for, you know, big elephant-looking things.
And from reading your book, this is partly a religious belief, was it not, of the time?
That the creator would not let things go extinct. So that world, that obviously Jefferson, we all recognize him as a brilliant mind, and found Humboldt was absolutely brilliant. But the world they lived in saw nature as something in perfect harmony, designed such that everything was in its place and sort of living in perfect harmony, both the living things and even the inanimate things, sort of like a landscape painting you know, that was not to be perturbed. And when Humboldt wrote his travels, he sort of copied Jefferson's style from his notes on the state of Virginia and wrote up numerous volumes on his travels through South America and Central America. And these volumes made Humboldt world famous.
And so Darwin would have read these.
Yeah, as a student at Cambridge, Darwin read von Humboldt's travels, and this inspired him to want to go to the tropics.
Did they correspond with each other?
Well, only after Darwin had written The Voyage of the Beagle. So only after Darwin's voyage did they correspond, and it's quite a touching correspondence between the young pupil who was inspired to take his voyage and the old sage of Europe. But what Darwin describes is very often he had these volumes of Humboldt and he was reading them just to buck up his courage on his own voyage because, you know, he was homesick. He was only a 22-year-old man when he went on the Beagle, and he was constantly seasick. And so
that's a bad place to be.
Yeah,
seasick.
That's a common. Yes, a 5-year voyage is not recommended. But von Humboldt's description of what he saw—that's what pulled Darwin, you know, to South America, and that's what kept him going. He didn't know what was going to be around the next bend, what was going to be in the next valley, what was going to be around the next bay. And the impact of prior travelers, you know, to inspire the next generation, well, that's still what goes on today.
Mm-hmm. You make the point that while Darwin did not set out on his journey with evolution in mind, two of his contemporaries did, Alfred Russel Wallace and Henry Walter. Bates.
Henry Walter Bates, yeah. They were younger than Darwin, so they had the benefit, for example, Darwin, to put the time frame on this, Darwin traveled from 1831 to 1836 and then wrote up The Voyage of the Beagle, his adventures, in the late 1830s. And so when Henry Walter Bates and Alfred Wallace were dreaming of going to the tropics, they had read Darwin and they had read Humboldt. And in the 1840s, the idea of at least the question of the origin of species was percolating in popular culture. And the fundamental question was whether species were specially created by God, immutable, or whether they had come about by natural laws. And so Wallace and Bates, who were two avid collectors, Wallace said, well, let's go to South America, to the Amazon, to collect facts to gather towards the question of the origin of species.
Mm-hmm. And, of course, there was a controversy that's been going on for years. Should Wallace be deemed the person who actually created the theory first, or be given credit or share it? Why has that surfaced? Was he so good and so close?
Yeah,
Wallace
was a remarkable man, and I think if Darwin was sitting right here today, he'd be heaping praise on Wallace. And I think what's happened is some amnesia Wallace has been gone almost 100 years. In his day, when Wallace had made his discoveries and the joint ideas of Wallace and Darwin had been presented, and then Darwin published The Origin of Species, Wallace was famous, and Wallace was getting quite a great deal of credit, and justifiably so, because what Wallace had done, and what people are generally not aware of, is that Wallace had traveled to the Amazon for 4 years, and once exhausted, headed home, only to have his ship catch fire and sink, and to lose all his specimens to the bottom of the Atlantic.
Everything he'd collected
went in the Amazon
went
down.
How many years of research?
4 years of collecting.
So you go out on the field, you brave all the elements, sickness, health, pirates, whatever. You got 4 years of collection, and you have nothing to show for it.
Nothing to show for it. And, of course, I think that would break a lot of people. And and he spent 10 days in an open lifeboat, not even knowing if he was going to be rescued. And while he said on the rescue ship home that, you know, he would never trust himself on the ocean again, as soon as he got back to England, he changed his mind, and he said, well, I'm not satisfied. I don't have answers towards the questions I wanted to ask. I don't have anything to show for the foreign lands that I have explored. And he went off, this time to the Malay Archipelago. He spent 8 years traipsing through the jungles of the Malay Archipelago collecting. He made 96 island-to-island crossings covering 14,000 miles. He collected 120,000 specimens.
And we don't hear about him at all.
No,
all of this, and it's just Darwin that we hear all the time.
Yeah, there's probably a complex set of reasons for that. But Wallace was a remarkable individual, and really Wallace saw similar things that Darwin had. Just as Darwin had seen species particular to particular islands of the Galapagos, say birds, Wallace saw butterflies that were unique to particular islands of the Malay Archipelago and inspired the same sort of thinking. And when you compare what these men were writing as they were putting their thoughts together, there's remarkable parallels to what they were thinking. And I think it's a great example of two great minds thinking alike.
And they got along, right?
They got along beautifully.
This, to me, is the most amazing part of it.
They got along beautifully. So
the competitiveness was not there.
No. I think the most telling is Wallace's private correspondence to friends, that he had nothing but the greatest admiration. And these letters are very touching, and they can be found, for example, on websites these days where a lot of this correspondence is documented. He had nothing but praise and admiration for Darwin. He was relieved that it was really Darwin that brought the theory to the public in the book On the Origin of Species. He felt that Darwin had created an entirely new branch of science, and he was...
Wow.
Quite happy to be mentioned in the same breath, or as Darwin did in The Origin of Species right at the outset, mentioned in Darwin's writing. And
right.
He dedicated his own book of his Malay Archipelago travels to Charles Darwin.
We're talking with Sean Carroll, author of Remarkable Creatures, Epic Adventures in the Search for the Origins of Species, and speaking of nothing but praise. I have nothing but praise for this book. This book is terrific. It's a great book for people who want to know all about the different adventurers. And we'll get into one of them a little bit later, who was actually the role model for Raiders of the Lost Ark. We'll talk about it after this break. So stay with us. We'll be right back from Tallahassee. Don't go away. I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from NPR News. You're listening to Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow here in Tallahassee. We're talking about this hour about the theory of evolution and all the folks who helped Darwin come to his conclusions and provide the evidence to prove he was right. A lot of them dug up the stuff he said that might be there. My guest is Sean B. Carroll, the author of Extraordinary Creatures, Epic Adventures in the Search for the Origins of Species. It's a terrific book. Let's see if we can get some phone calls in before we go on to the next question. If you're here in the audience, please step up to the mic. Let's go to the phones. Let's see if we can go to Ron in Harborough, Pennsylvania. Hi, Ron, are you there? Well, let's go to Brian in Baltimore. Hi, Brian. Hi there, Brian.
Hey, how you doing?
Hi there. Go ahead.
Hi. Okay, I got a question. Well, you made the comment about Jefferson, and it kind of dawned on me that, with some hindsight, you could have such brilliant people as Jefferson who could think of things in terms of what was known of the day. My question kind of pertains to that in terms of what other scientists had theories out there that were being considered at the time in competition with the theory of evolution. I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
Okay, thanks for calling.
Well, one of the most prominent ones was Lamarck in France, a great zoologist. So there were many fantastic scientists, geologists and biologists or zoologists that were trying to make sense of what they saw in nature. And Lamarck had basically the idea that changes could take place in a lifetime that then would be passed on to their offspring. So he was aware that change was taking place, but didn't have the right idea about how that happened. Mm-hmm. So Lamarck would probably be the most popular idea that was prevalent in Europe at the time, but had not gained traction in England.
Mm. Let's talk about some of the other terrific characters that you have. I say that with all great love for them, of course, being one myself, some sort of character. Another one is Eugene Dubois.
Yeah.
This
is unbelievable. This is I think this is the most single-minded expedition I know of in all of natural history. So Dubois is a physician, a Dutch physician, a young physician. He's climbing the ranks. He's brilliant. He's succeeded everything he's touched. But he's read a lot, and he's reading a lot. This is now in the 1880s, so it's well after The Origin of Species, but there's a lot of discussion about humans. What about humans? What about the origin of humans? And he gets it in his mind that the most important thing that anybody could discover is the link between apes and humans, and that he's going to be the one to do it. And so he's thinking, well, where could I find this link? And he decides, well, he's kind of looking at a world map, and he thinks, I think it's going to be in Asia, not Africa. And looking at that map, gee, where could I go? Well, the Dutch East Indies are a Dutch colony. How could I pay my way? Well, I'm a physician. I'll enlist in the Dutch army.
What a great idea.
So he was about to be a full professor of medicine at the University of Amsterdam, and without telling his wife, he enlisted for 8 years in the Dutch army.
I think there was a message there somewhere.
Well, she went along with it, and they had a young baby, and so that was it. They left Amsterdam for Sumatra, and he went and started to be experienced with diseases that he didn't even know existed in the world, but started exploring the caves on Sumatra. And he thought, because that's where Neanderthals had been found in Europe, that ancient hominids, ancient humans, would be found in caves. And after sometime in Sumatra, he said, this doesn't look so good. I'm going to move over to Java. So he uproots the family again, moves over to Java, and he gets a crew of workmen helping him. And sure enough, after about 4 years, they find a molar, a skull cap, and a thigh bone. This guy has hit the jackpot. It's what we call today Homo erectus. And to understand how lucky Dubois was, what you have to realize is that as soon as he made this find, all sorts of people wanted to follow his footsteps to Asia. No one found anything else for 40 years. So on the Trinil River in Java, he finds these hominid fossils. You've got to think this is the luckiest dart
that
anyone has ever found.
Well, but doesn't that cast doubt on his finding if everybody's saying, we're not finding another one?
Well, then they
did.
And 40 years later, in the late 1920s, then they found more Homo erectus on Java, and more things were found in China, and the picture was fleshed out.
Is this Java Man?
This is Java Man. That's right, yeah. So Eugene Dubois was certainly opened a whole new vista on human origins. But you have to appreciate, and there's a picture actually in the book that I love, because the veranda of his house is piling up with bones. You got to realize when you're looking for human fossils, you're finding all the other animals that lived at that time, a lot of big animals with big bones. And so he's unearthing tons and tons and tons of bones, really looking for a needle in a haystack of other mammal bones. And he finds that needle. It's a remarkable good fortune, but you know, hard-earned good fortune, because he put his life on the line to explore these caves and riverbeds in Indonesia.
1-800-989-8255 is the number. Talking with Sean B. Carroll, author of Remarkable Creatures. Let's talk about the model for Indiana Jones. And there really is one, is there not?
Yeah, George Lucas has admitted this to some degree. Roy Chapman Andrews. So this is a fellow who grew up in Beloit, Wisconsin, and liked the outdoors in the late 1800s. And he collected things, kept them up in his attic, labeled them, and went to the Field Museum in Chicago, and made a big impression on him that he wanted to work in a natural history museum. So when he graduated college, he was not a very good student. He actually was really good at taxidermy, paid his way through college by stuffing the hunting trophies of Wisconsin hunters. Went to the Natural History Museum and applied for a job, and the director tried to kind of ease him down gently and said, well, you know, look, we don't have any position here for you. And he said, but you need somebody to sweep the floors, don't you? And he said, hey, a man with a college degree doesn't want to sweep floors. And Roy Chapman Andrews said, yeah, but these aren't just any floors. So his first job was as a floor sweeper at the American Museum of Natural History. Now, making long story short, he was eager to get any kind of real work, and he wound up working on whales. And that sent him all over the world. And he fell in love with the Orient, and he wanted to explore Asia. And he wanted to mount some tremendous expedition. And he got the idea of exploring the Gobi Desert, Inner Mongolia, and mounting the largest natural history expedition ever undertaken. Now, this is going to cost a lot of money.
Yeah, there's no National Science Foundation.
There's no government support for this. But he had learned, he had rubbed shoulders a little bit when he was at the museum with some of the donors to the museum and people like Andrew Carnegie. And so he went around to the titans of industry and finance in New York, J.P. Morgan, the Rockefellers, Chase, told them about this grand idea. And the reason why he was partly going into Inner Mongolia, he wanted to find hominid fossils. He was selling this whole expedition on the idea that they would find more ancient man, just as Dubois had found several decades earlier. And so they all ponied up a serious amount of money, and he put together this plan that involved a caravan of camels that would head out early and have their supplies out in the desert, and then he would travel in with a team of geologists and other paleontologists and a cinematographer. He had a good mind for publicity. Mm-hmm. And in a fleet of cars, 1922 vehicles, and bounced their way across the Gobi Desert looking for ancient hominids. And they didn't find any.
So they went home with nothing, right?
Well, not quite. They weren't in the desert but a couple days, and they started finding fossils, dinosaur fossils, mammal fossils, everywhere. They found dinosaurs. They sort of described places. It was almost as though they were as common as sheep on hillsides. And they found, for example, what we know today as Velociraptor. They found Oviraptor. They found the first dinosaur eggs. They found the first evidence of mammals living alongside dinosaurs. So they didn't find any what they had set out to find, but they found terrific stuff that made great copy. The dinosaur eggs wound up on the cover of Time magazine, and Roy Chapman Andrews became world famous. And he repeated this expedition for several years through the 1920s, piling up quite a great collection. And he was a great yarn spinner.
Yeah, and he had actually, if you see, there's a great picture in your book on Remarkable Creatures. He's sitting there on a rock with a six-shooter.
That's
just
right.
Like Indiana Jones, and the hat and the
whole bit, right?
His
trademark, he always carried a pistol and a ranger hat. Now, you might think those were props, but where he was going in the Gobi Desert, he had to use the pistol, in fact, a few times to ping off some shots to scare away bandits. The roads that they traveled were often victimized by bandits. It was pretty rough country. But he had this whole style about him, and he brought a cinematographer. So there is footage of these expeditions at the American Museum of Natural History has all this archival footage, which is just fantastic, watching these cars bounce across the desert, seeing the fossils be excavated, the first dinosaur eggs being shown. And the same person that did the cinematography did beautiful landscape photography. So the still photography of this expedition is fantastic. So it was a lot of fun to research all this. But he became famous and appeared in a lot of newsreels back in the U.S., and George Lucas has been quoted as saying that, you know, as a boy, as he watched these newsreels that were often shown before featured films, that people like Roy Chapman Andrews were featured in these things, and the whole ranger hat and the gun and, you know, going into the desert and sort of the swashbuckling nature of it in some way became incorporated into the character of Indiana Jones.
Wow. 1-800-999-8255. Let's go to this gentleman in the audience. Yes, sir.
You were talking about Wallace and the fact that his ship went down, it burnt. Has there ever been any talk of an expedition to go and see if they can recover anything? Would there be anything to recover? You got me thinking about Indiana Jones now, so this whole...
Yeah, that's a good question.
That's a great question. I don't know how deep the water is. This was somewhere about 700 or 800 miles east of Bermuda, so I don't know how deep that would be, and I don't know how well this ship would hold up. But I don't know how much burned, because obviously if it really just burned while on the surface and then all you had was embers that sank, it would be a little bit different. But it's a great question. One thing I thought about doing is this ship was most likely insured. So I've been tempted to go next time in London to go to Lloyd's Records, because there's records of all these shipwrecks, and see what else we can learn about what people know about that ship, whether there was any effort to salvage anything. So it's something well worth looking into.
Wow, I would imagine that it'd be hard. The things that are wrecked in the ocean are hard to find. Gold lasts forever, but fossils might not.
And butterflies even less so.
Butterflies, yeah. you have said that you believe we are in a second golden age of biology. What do you mean by that?
Well, a second golden age of evolutionary biology. I think the first golden age was this era of these great voyages, particularly of Darwin and Wallace and Bates and their discoveries and their writings, the birth of the theory of evolution. But in terms of understanding how evolution works, there's been a transformation, certainly in the last couple decades, where biologists, you know, all over the world are able to see in great detail how adaptation works, how evolution works, how different forms of the animal and the plant kingdom have evolved. They've been able to resolve the tree of life, the tree that Darwin first drew and actually said that sometime we'll have a complete tree of life and understand the relationships of all the creatures on the planet. And that dream is much closer because of the power that's come through understanding the DNA record of evolution. And this DNA record has absolutely exploded. 20 years ago, if you typed out all the DNA information scientists have gathered and put it in a normal-sized book, it would just fill one volume, just like that book. But if you now typed out all the DNA information we have and stacked those books, it'd be somewhere close to 2 miles high. And we're just mining this record for information about how species adapt to particular habitats, the history of life, and some of the new volumes going into that record are from extinct species. So the capability now to sequence DNA from woolly mammoths, from fossil material, including Neanderthals, our closest extinct cousin, is giving us tremendous amount of information about the past.
Now, you sort of switched careers for a little bit to write this book, right? You're an evolutionary biologist, but you're writing a historical book. When you go in and you look at the records, do you say, what am I doing here? This is not my topic, but I'm yet making all these discoveries that some of the great historians may have missed.
Well, I don't know about great historians missing. There is a chance, I think. Certainly, I think every historian would say that they're going to take a fresh look at any historical record. But the historical record is at the same time being opened up to people like myself and anyone in the audience with a browser. Because a lot of these documents, including correspondence and rough manuscripts and field diaries and notebooks and all that, are being put online. And I found some of the gems that I used in this book really from that I didn't know existed from any other source when I looked at rough drafts and said, my goodness, look at what he's saying. Look at how he's saying it. Something that may not be present, for example, in the published form of later work.
So you could actually see, let me just remind everybody that this is Science Friday from NPR News. I'm Ira Flatow talking with Sean Carroll, author of Remarkable Creatures. Could you actually look at Darwin's rough draft?
Oh, absolutely.
And see things that were not there in the final?
Oh, yeah. Certainly. There are big changes between, as Darwin wrote down, he first wrote about a 35-page sketch of his idea about species in 1842. I can happily say that now I've seen that online. I actually held it in my hands. And then 2 years later, extended that to about 230 pages. And while there's resemblance to what we see in The Origin of Species, clearly these ideas were changing. And some things he decided not to emphasize at all. So some of his early writings, he was very much pointing out how his thinking was absolutely at odds with creationism, with the creationist idea that every species was specially created. You won't find any of that language in On the Origin of Species. Mm-hmm.
You write that that Darwin played a dodging game for 20 years. What was he dodging?
Well, he was dodging that very fact. He was dodging his concern, certainly as a young man, just coming back from the voyage when he realized that species do change, and this was heresy. The doctrine, the dogma was that species were immutable, created by God. And he thought, no, species come about in a natural process, as natural as the way, you know, waves, you know, shape the seacoast or the way planets move around in the heavens. He knew that he couldn't go public with this. And there was a mixture of concerns. One was, you know, he wanted more evidence. Another was the people who had trained him, for whom he had very tender feelings, the people who, such as Reverend John Henslow, who he corresponded with throughout the voyage and who always bucked up his courage and received specimens from Darwin and distributed them to the best experts in the country. I mean, Darwin loved Henslow. And, you know, Reverend John Henslow, if you were a member of the Cambridge or Oxford faculty, you were an ordained clergyman of the Anglican Church, and this was... to say that species change was heresy, you know, to these men. And so, you know, he was sensitive to that. And his courage didn't really grow until much later.
So he put off publishing for 20 years.
Yeah.
He could have done 20 years before.
Oh, yeah. In 1844, he had a 230-page manuscript that spells it all out in really full detail. And he said to his wife at the time, he said, you know, should I die, you know, see to it this is published. So he was willing to have it published after he was dead, but not while he was alive. At least that was his thinking in 1844.
Did he feel Wallace breathing down his neck or other scientists that he felt, I'd better do this now?
No, he didn't feel in the 1840s, he didn't feel that sort of urgency.
But 20 years later, what finally was the...
Well, he always said he was going to write this big book, and he was working on the big book for a few years when Wallace's letter from the Malay Archipelago arrived. And he said to his friends, whom he had confided all his thoughts to, he said, you know, Wallace couldn't have written a better abstract of my theory if he had had, you know, all my notebooks in front of him. So he saw, you know, immediately that what Wallace had conceived was you know, the nucleus of the idea that he had. And I think that had to give Darwin the energy to complete the big book that we know as On the Origin of Species.
Mm-hmm. And he published it right then.
A year after 1859.
That's where we get that 150th anniversary.
That's right.
This year. All right, we're going to take a short break and come back and talk more with Sean B. Carroll, who's author of Remarkable Creatures, Epic Adventures in the Search for the Origins of Species. Also joining us will be Dee Bruce Means, He's going to talk about a little thing, stuff a little bit closer to home, and that's stuff here in Florida. So stay with us. We'll be right back after this short break. I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from NPR News. You're listening to Science Friday from NPR News. I'm Ira Flatow here in Tallahassee in Florida, broadcasting from the Origins 09 conference on origins. Very interesting stuff that's going on down here. And we're talking this hour about evolution and the remarkable naturalists and scientists who traverse the globe, were facing all kinds of hardships, collecting evidence that Darwin needed to cement his theory. With me is Dr. Sean B. Carroll, who is author of Remarkable Creatures, Epic Adventures in the Search for the Origins of Species. And also joining us now is another very famous naturalist who, you know, because we are broadcasting from FSU this hour, FSU is in Tallahassee. And while you may know Tallahassee is the state capital, you may not know that the area around the capital is a really hot spot of biodiversity in North America, and it's actually happening right here on our desk at the moment, where a snake has magically appeared out of the pocket of my next guest, and that's Dr. D. Bruce Means. He is the author of Stalking the Plumed Serpent and Other Adventures in Herpetology. He's president and executive director of the Coastal Plains Institute and Land Conservancy and adjunct professor of biology at Florida State University. He has also recently described a new family of frogs, not here in the Panhandle, but in Guyana, and we'll ask him about that. And if you want to check out one of Bruce Means' Eastern Diamondbacks that he caught near Tallahassee, you can go to our website at sciencefriday.com and watch Flora Lichtman's latest sci-fi pick of the week. And we went out there yesterday. Flora went out there and got a good look at the diamondback. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you, Ira. Delighted to be here.
That was some trick you just did. I've been upstage many times. I'm never by a snake coming out of right here on Science Friday.
Yeah, it doesn't make the impact that a video show would have had, but...
There is an awful lot of biodiversity around here in North Florida, is there not?
Absolutely, and that's what the snake is all about. This is a race of kingsnake found just in this area. And the area between Tallahassee and Pensacola, Florida, is very special because it's highly rich in species of plants and animals. For instance, it has more snakes, more frogs, more turtles, and a whole bunch of other things in high numbers in the United States and Canada. So it's a biodiversity hotspot of great importance, and not very much is known about it.
And you actually have a subspecies of snake named.
Well, that's this guy here. Yeah.
How did that happen?
Oh, golly, it goes back to the 1960s. I've been here a long time. I used to ride through the National Forest locally, and I found this strange-looking snake. It's a king snake, which normally is black with rings, light rings around it. And this thing is totally solidly colored, light-colored animal. And the long story of it is I did what biologists have done, trying to understand the variation in animals. I bred different individuals to each other, got young, crossbred them, bred them back to the parents, and I crossed this thing with the normal kingsnake. And what I discovered was it's a race that's uniquely found in one area between two rivers, and one wants to ask, well, how did that develop? You look for an isolating mechanism, and right in the middle of that spot are two old barrier islands that apparently the early populations got established there, and the snake, you know, drifted and color matches the sand of the background. And that particular area has 15 plants that are endemic to the same region. So it's looking at biodiversity by understanding the variation that occurs in animals and plants.
So you can have an evolutionary process going on just in the island next door.
Absolutely. In fact, that's classic. Yeah,
that's classic. I mean, but it's something as close as right outside your own backyard.
That's true. All over the world, that's been the case.
Mm-hmm. Tell us about the difference. I think most Americans are familiar with southern Florida. It's in the news a lot. It's got the swamps. Right. It's got all kinds of different stuff we see on the news. But how is the biodiversity different in the Panhandle than it is in the Everglades and the other places in the Florida?
Very different. It's quite easy to explain, as a matter of fact. Peninsula Florida, as you go down the peninsula, it becomes less and less relief. There's less and less physical diversity. And there's a thing called the peninsula effect that happens with plants and animals. The plants and animals that occur at the base of the peninsula, 50 to 60% of them don't make the tip of the peninsula. For instance, the whole bottom of the peninsula is the Everglades, whereas up here we have lots of relief, ravines and things that we don't have down in South Florida. And this is continental up here. You know, the peninsula is a flatter, lower-lying land. So, and it also jets into the warmer climes of the world. Mm-hmm. So you'd expect things to be different down there, and indeed they are. And up here we have this wonderful hotspot.
Wow. And you also have cooler weather up here, right, than you have down in southern Florida.
Right, we certainly do. But not as cold as I don't like. I was raised in Alaska, and I came here to get away from Alaska.
Such a difference. Let's see if we have any questions from there. Anybody up there at the mic want to ask a question? Yes, step up, please. Go ahead.
Yes, Dr. Carroll, both. I hope everyone's coping with our pollen pretty well here. So, but Dr. Carroll, you mentioned last night briefly about genetic research that's kind of looking back, trying to hopefully explain and support natural selection. Can you give a couple of examples? I mean, have there been genetic research that kind of helps explain diversity?
Oh, absolutely. There's been an explosion of information about adaptation of all sorts of creatures, and I hate to tell you, but it's all plugged in another book called The Making of the Fittest. Understanding how all sorts of species, mice, fish, plants, et cetera, are adapting to their local conditions and documenting how that's occurring at the DNA level and where do new traits come from, where do new capabilities come from. There's many, many, many case studies now where that's well documented. Color vision, for example, in animals is another case. So just say in the last 10 years, there's just dozens and dozens of examples where we know the precise basis of adaptation at the DNA level.
Mm-hmm. Thanks. Yes, sir. Why don't you just step up and ask the next question? Go ahead.
Also, you were talking about how Darwin found homified bones. Did his theory, was it incorrect or correct?
Well, Darwin himself found all sorts of fossils when he was on the Beagle of mammals. He found things that were related to sloths and to armadillos and to llamas and things like that. He didn't know anything about really human fossils. But his idea that species change is certainly correct, and his idea that fossils represented older, now extinct creatures, but were related and gave rise to the current living species, was certainly correct. But he was waiting for a lot more evidence to understand the whole history of life, and that's what a whole lot more scientists had to contribute to over the last 150 years.
Mm-hmm. Bruce, Florida is obviously not a good enough place to spend all your time, because you've been going to Guyana, and you actually have found some interesting new things there. Tell us about that.
Yes, the kind of work that Sean does is work that I need to do. You know, I'm an old-fashioned biologist that looks at the animals and tries to figure out whether I have different species based on their morphology. But it turns out the DNA that we use mm-hmm. for human fingerprint analysis and the like is very, very, I mean, for finding out whether human, right. you know, different, is very, very useful. And so if you apply it to a bunch of salamanders that you can't tell apart morphologically, the DNA will tell you, oh, yeah, these are related to each other because they have much closer genetic relationships and these don't, and therefore you may have a new species. Any person who is a field biologist who's trained in the temperate zones of the world, and most of us are, in order to really understand evolution and ecology, we need to have some experience in the tropics because the world, for most of its history, and even now, has more tropical environments than it does, well, has always had more tropical
right.
environments than temperate ones.
Right.
So I went by backpack to South America when I was younger, 25 years ago, and I started exploring one particularly wonderful area that I've fallen in love with, and that's led to lots of interesting things.
Mm-hmm. And you talked about, what about your frogs, the family of frogs?
And those indeed are some of those interesting things. I've been exploring mountains in Guyana, and which used to be British Guiana, Venezuela, and Brazil, that rise to almost 10,000 feet. They're flat-topped mesas, but they're clothed with rainforests on the slopes, and the upper slopes are cloud forests. A lot of people have studied them by helicoptering to the summits, but nobody's done any transects of the slopes because you can't land there.
Right.
So I've been trying to do that, and I've found all these. Every time I go back to one of these mountains, it's only 35 kilometers by 17, and I've made three expeditions there, and every time I find two or three new frogs, new to science, I've got an earthworm that's about 4 feet long, big around as...
So you were looking for frogs and discovered the earthworm.
The earthworm, crabs, and the whole bunch. But among these frogs, and here's where the DNA comes in, among these frogs, they all look relatively similar. And so I collaborated with people who have a DNA lab, and two of these little frogs were so different from all the rest of them that they are a family of frogs, unique, because their DNA is so different. And in fact, they fit in a category between all the frogs that, there are many frogs in the New World that lay eggs that develop directly into little froglets. But then all the other frogs, as we know, the more primitive condition is to lay eggs that develop into tadpoles. This one's in between, and we don't know what it does. And guess what? Isn't that a rise on for going back?
Absolutely. Doing more work? Isn't it great when we don't know what something does?
Yes, yes.
I mean, you know, that's the best part about science, is finding the thing we don't know what it does.
That's right.
You know? Sean, these people you were talking about in your book found a lot of things that they didn't know what did or where they came from or what the fossils meant.
No, and that was the joy of their lives, is pursuing, exploring the unknown, not knowing what was around the corner. And you know, Bruce is the embodiment of this. He's exploring territories that still exist in the world that people do not know what is there, and discovering things that bridge important gaps in our knowledge and science.
Mm. Would you like to have been around then, Bruce, with those guys?
Oh, yes, indeed. It was easier to find all kinds of new things, but that's not what it's all about. What it's about is, in order to know how important biodiversity is, you have to know what the components of the species. It's not so easy to have a eureka moment where you say, oh, there's a new species, when you're out these days. But using the techniques of DNA and other new biological techniques, there still is plenty out there to find. In fact, E.O. Wilson and others have claimed we only know about 10% of the animals and plants on this planet.
And a lot of those are vanishing.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. But you don't know they're vanishing.
Yeah.
Vanishing if you don't know what they are. So
right.
We still have lots of that basic work to do.
Let's see if we can go to the audience. Ask a question here. Yes, step right up.
Yeah. I have a question for Mr. Carroll. Earlier on, you mentioned how Wallace and Darwin were such beautiful friends. I was wondering, were there any people in his time that tried to put him down or, you know, use his ideas and claim them as their own, since I know that some people cheated Archimedes in that way?
That's a great question. Darwin faced a lot of opposition. And in fact, we should be talking about Owen as the father of evolution, because there was a person in England, the person who named, for example, the word dinosaur, and who is the leading expert on fossils that were being excavated from, especially all over the shoreline of England, long before Darwin came back from the Beagle. But Owen absolutely rejected any idea that species changed, and he was really a bitter enemy of Darwin's ideas. So there were people, many people, who in the scientific establishment who opposed Darwin's ideas at first, and Darwin just had to wait for them to die off. Mm.
Talking about evolution this hour on Science Friday from NPR News. I'm Ira Flatow here in Tallahassee with Sean Carroll and Bruce Means. Sean is author of the book, The Remarkable Creatures, Epic Adventures in the Search for the Origins of Species. That last comment you made about scientists waiting for them, others to die off is universal, is it not, through the history of science?
I think it's part of human nature.
That's how, you know, books have been written about to get a new idea accepted. You just have to wait for the old guy to... Now an old woman might have to die off. They didn't have women in science years ago. Let's see if we can go right to the audience. Lots of questions there. Yes, sir, please.
Okay, for Dr. Carroll, how much... the publication in 1859 of Natural Selection as an Explanation of Evolutionary Change, how much of that was due to the spark of insight of Darwin and Wallace? How much was it due uniquely to them, or was it on the immediate horizon just due to the mass of descriptive biology that was being accumulated at that time?
I would say it was the vast majority of that was the credit to Darwin and Wallace. This was a revolutionary idea. And the two boldest ideas that Darwin had, the idea that all living species had descended from ancestors who had descended from earlier ancestors all the way back, I don't think anyone could claim they had that idea. And the idea of natural selection as a mechanism for change. And Darwin presented such an integrated synthesis of evidence from so many fields that while there may have been people that had some notions about species changing or variation among individuals and things like this, Darwin really pulled it all together. You know, I think it's sort of like saying, well, there were some baseball players around, but this was Darwin and Wallace. They were the Babe Ruth and Joe DiMaggio, you know, of the time. They were really at the actual, you know, top of the game and had the most information that was most pertinent to the solution to the big questions.
I only have about a minute left. Are there other people you would have liked to have put in? I mean, how did you do triage whom to leave out in the book?
Well, I mean, there were a lot of criteria. They had to do something dramatic. They had to find something important, and I actually had to admire them. I didn't write about anybody I didn't like. There was so much I found to admire in these people. I think it put a pretty good collection together.
You got one name who you would maybe make the second?
No, cut? I think I look forward to writing the next book about the next 20 years of adventures that people are going to undertake, because some of these stories were just completed in 2006 and 2007. The passion is very much alive in the scientific
community.
Who's
out there now? Who's working now?
Well, the paleontologists. I mean, yeah. Darwin didn't know a lot about the history of life. The paleontologists, Darwin said that the crust of the earth is a vast museum. We've only uncovered a tiny percentage of what's down there.
It's a great way to end. I want to thank you both for taking time to be with us. Bruce Means, who is a local hero here in northern Florida and the Panhandle. He's head of the Coastal Plains Institute. Sean Carroll, author of Remarkable Creatures, Epic Adventures in the Search for the Origins of Species. Gentlemen, thank you for taking time to be with us today.
Thank you.
This program is produced by Christopher Intagliata, senior producer Annette Heist. Charles Berquist is our director here in Tallahassee. Gwen Uden directed from Washington, D.C. Flora Lichtman is our producer for digital media. Laura Pelcher, our SciArts producer. Our intern is Shelley Du Bois. Melissa Marquis is our technical director. We had help from audio engineers Kimberly Jones, also here in Tallahassee. And our phone screeners are Kareem Estefan and Suzanne George. And we'd like to thank Florida State University, FSU's Office of Research, its College of Medicine, also the Tallahassee Scientific Society, and also the Florida Humanities Council for making our program possible here in Tallahassee. Thank you all for helping us out here. In Second Life, we had... Yeah, you can applaud if you like. In Second Life, we had help from Lynn Collins, Dave Andrews, Jeff Corbin, University of Denver. And if you'd like to write to us, go to our Science Friday website at sciencefriday.com. We're podcasting, tweeting, twittering, and everything else we can think of to do in the Second Life kind of world. I'm Ira Flato in Tallahassee.